So good afternoon, everybody. It's great to see you all here, and we hope that we're going to have a really stimulating time together for the next hour or so. We have some real experts in their fields on the stage, but we also have some experts in this field sat here. So we want to hear from you, hear your questions and your reflections and what the common good means to you, as well as have a conversation up here. So what I'm going to do is ask each member of the panel to introduce themselves a little bit more fully so you get an idea of where they're coming from and their passion. And then I'll ask each of them to, for about 5 minutes, to introduce this theme of the common good, what it means to them, and to tease out some of the tensions within that and some of the different nuances of the common good. And then we will open it out to you and then move on to develop the theme together. So, Ed, would you like to start and tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you get up to?
Thanks very much, Karen. I'm Ed Mayo. My motto is, I'm interested in things that I know nothing about, and that's kind of defined what I've done. Karen said I should talk about my passion, and passion, of course, is such a funny word. It's such a overused word in many ways. Did you mean my suffering, or did you mean my joy? But it is my joy, and sometimes my suffering, to work in the... Sorry. I'm not going to repeat that. It's my pleasure to work in the ethical economy, and that's the core to what I do. I work at Cooperatives UK, which is a network of cooperatives and mutuals across the country.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm Anna Rowlands, and I work at the University of Durham, and my passion is to relate theology, the ideas and the practices of the Christian tradition, to real stuff in everyday life. And I'm an expert on Catholic social teaching, a tradition that runs in particular from the late 1800s to the contemporary day, and that Pope Francis has made live and nicely controversial again. And I also work a lot on immigration, which I think is a defining issue of our generation, morally speaking, and is a particularly tough, challenging one in terms of thinking about the common good as well.
Thank you.
Very lovely to be. I grew up in kind of Greenbelt circles. I've moved to the States about 5 or 6 years ago, and so it's a great joy to be back here. I'm Luke Bretherton, and Londoner born and bred, but now live in North Carolina and teach at Duke. My particular area of interest is related between Christianity and democracy, both in terms of how we understand that theologically and kind of the history and tradition of that, but also how it's lived out in practice around the world. But I was kind of cut my teeth in practice with Citizens UK as a leader in community organizing, and was involved in a number of campaigns there, particularly a campaign to introduce responsible lending in the realm of consumer credit. And so try and sit on this kind of cusp point between translating what's going on in the political world to the church, and trying to help what's going on in the political world understand how Christianity and the church relate to that.
Thank you. And as Claire said, I'm Karen Rooms. I'm a clergy and was vicar in St. Anne's in the inner city in Nottingham. And I got involved in community organizing as a faith leader. And we built an alliance of 40 organizations, ranging from Trent Vineyard Church to the Women's Center, HIMA, an Islamic justice organization, through Malawian Black Majority Church, at the RCN, and a whole collection across faith, labor, and education in Nottingham, Trent University, amongst others. And together we listened in our communities to the issues that were affecting our people, and gathered together and had democratic process to agree what are the issues we want to act together on across our city, and what do we want to change, and what do we want to negotiate for change with Nottingham City Council and and the county council and our local businesses. So, for example, we got a hate crime post in the police 0.5 and the city council 0.5 funded a specific post where hate crime can be measured and people have confidence to report hate crime to them. We got protocols for homeless 16 and 17 year olds after we listened to the young people in one church in particular, who were saying we're petrified going into the main hostel down on the London Road. Is there not a better way for us to transition through this difficult phase of our lives? So they were the sort of issues that we acted on together. And that was using the model of community organising, broad-based organising of different institutions and their communities to act together, we say, for the common good. So what is the common good? So I think I'm going to ask Anna to kick us off. I'm going to give you 5 minutes just to introduce the common good and perhaps take us into Catholic social teaching and how those two fit together.
Okay, so I agreed to take the short straw, which is I get to set up the position a little bit so that the others then get to explain why it's nowhere near that easy. Okay, so that's just to get some sympathy for you, for my position to start with, okay, get you on my side. Okay, so the common good is not an idea that is necessarily terribly well defined. It's something that we find ourselves thinking about. We keep using the language. There's some reason why that phrase remains resonant over thousands and thousands of years. And yet when you try and define it and put your finger on it, it can be pretty difficult to do that. So I'm going to do a quick kind of run through the family album, okay? So you have to imagine that this is like a photo album, and I'm going to flick through the pages really quickly just so that you get a glimpse of what various members of the common good family look like, okay? So I'm going to start with Aristotle. So it's not a Christian idea. It's not an idea that Christians, even Catholics, invented, okay? That was a humble Catholic moment. I hope you noticed that. There won't be any more. Okay, so Aristotle kind of invents the idea in one sense in the modern consciousness, because he says, look, if we're going to do something when we live together that's more than just trying not to kill and injure each other and trading stuff with each other, we need to have a way of thinking about that. And the common good, acting for a good that is in common between us, that belongs to all of us, is a thing that we should be orientated towards doing, or else society doesn't really mean very much if it's just not killing each other and just trading stuff. So if we want justice, if we want fraternity, then we have to say that there's a name for this thing. So the common good is a name for that. Now, for Aristotle, he's talking about small-scale communities, so where people can get to know each other and argue and discuss this stuff out, okay? So that's his focus. Now, Cicero thinks a similar thing, but he adds an interesting twist to the idea. So he says, okay, you want to imagine the common good of Bradford, or the common good of the neighborhood around your streets. Well, that's fine, but you're only going to be able to achieve that common good for your neighborhood or for your city if you can also stretch your mind to thinking about a universal common good. If you can think that you belong to a universal human family, that there is kinship and equality between all peoples, because if you forget that universal horizon, you won't actually be able to achieve it for your own face-to-face community. So there's a kind of tension there, and I reckon Luke will come and unpick and challenge some of that shortly, okay? So that's a little bit on the classical stuff. Now, bearing in mind the common good is basically arguing about what community means, we should expect that the events of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus should throw up in the air, for Christians, another version of the common good, because it changes, the Christian story changes the dimensions of what we mean by community, doesn't it? So therefore, you should expect a renewal of the common good tradition, which is exactly what happens. So this happens with Augustine, but it most famously happens with Aquinas. But it also happens, and I want to stop here really briefly, with the patristic fathers, so the early church fathers. And there's three key themes of the common good that come out from the early church fathers. One, surprisingly, is to do with the church itself, that all the church's practices, its own institutional community life, the goal of all those practices is to build the common good. So worship, preaching, pastoral care all have to be thought about with a mind towards that. It's there in St. Paul, St. Paul's image of the body. All these practices, he says, and he uses the phrase, are for the common good. So that's the first emphasis. And they're really strict on the fact that Christian unity and getting doctrine broadly right are actually key contributions that the church makes to the good of the world. Okay? So the second patristic theme is economics. So the early church fathers perhaps taught more about economics as a key dimension of the common good than perhaps sometimes we do now. And I think Ed might pick up on some of that in a little while. And the key teaching from the patristics around economics is about just distribution. But it's also, they have this really key teaching about the flow of capital. So they're not anti-money or necessarily anti-property. Some are, some aren't. But the emphasis is on the flow of capital so that all may benefit. And they have this wonderful image, which is the distinction between wealth, not just money wealth, but wealth of different kinds, as being like a flowing river or like a stagnant pool. And when wealth accumulates as a stagnant pool, it rottens the community, it rots the community, okay? So that's a second key economic theme. The third theme is around politics, and it echoes those ideas from Aristotle and Cicero, that basically it's about political authority, okay? So three key themes from them. And then, have I got one more minute left, or am I over my 5 minutes?
Well, you're getting there.
Okay. So very quickly, some of the things that Aquinas adds, so quickly skipping to the medieval period, Aquinas makes a really interesting point. He says, look, if you're going to talk about the common good, what matters in terms of defining community is the goal you have in mind. So if you think there's nothing else in life other than your own self-realization, your own self-actualization, then there are key goals that you're going to set for yourself. You're going to want to amass property and wealth. You're going to want to have health because you're going to want to live a long time if the only thing around here is you and your self-actualization. And finally, you're also going to want to amass knowledge of various kinds. But say that you suddenly discover that actually there is something beyond yourself, another reality, that's totally going to change the way you think about your end goals. So if the goal is something beyond yourself, having a common good that only achieves those things won't work. So we need to think about law and politics in such a way that we can achieve goods, key goods, together. And that means we're going to need to practice certain virtues. So the common good for Aquinas becomes practicing key virtues to do with prudence and justice and so forth. So that's his key contribution. And I'm going to save the Catholic social teaching bit and see if we come back to that, because I think I've thrown out enough that other people can deliberately now challenge, disrupt, and take us further.
Luke.
Okay. So I get to be the grouchy, snarky Protestant who I'm going to add another page to the family album, and it's a rather sour-faced page of Luther and Calvin, great heroes. And of course, they come in and say, well, hold on a second. Amen to all you've said, true, but. And the but is, what about the fall? What about the fact that we're finite, fallen creatures? We have limited knowledge, we're sinful, idolatrous people who chase after the wrong things. How do we know what the common good is? How do we know what this thing is? And not only that, we're locked in relations of power. Calvin very kind of concerned about this. We need institutions to bounce off each other and hold each other in check and discipline each other. And so how can we even talk about a notion of the common good? If our ability to know the truth and know the good is so limited, we need grace and we need discipline to be able to know it. And out of this, there emerges a whole kind of Protestant tradition, which runs in parallel to the Catholic tradition of thinking about these questions. And particularly then the place of politics and a kind of contesting politics within that. It's roughly called Protestant resistance theory. It's great stuff. Thoroughly recommend it. In that, what there's this idea that we can only come to know the good as fallen and finite creatures who are often doing bad things to each other through a kind of careful dance of conflict and conciliation, where actually I'm not the same as you, you're not the same as me, but by coming into relationship and negotiating this process, we can kind of gradually discover what our goods in common are. And then we can work together on them. But there has to be, but it's a political process that goes from the bottom up. Because some of the classical Greek ideas of the common good were somehow we'll have some enlightened, rationally thinking, normally men, who will know rightly how to organize the body politic, and they'll determine then how everyone else should live. And what emerges out of the more kind of Protestant and then latterly more democratic understandings is it's only through the participation of a broad range of people and their involvement that we can begin to discover together. Now, key difference is, and where we kind of double back to, say, further amen to what Anna was saying, is this idea that do we live in a cosmos that has something to teach us about how to live well? So whatever the differences and conflicts between us, we're participating in a moral universe, and through this kind of shared struggle and conflict and conciliation we go through together, we can gradually discover goods in common. Or are we just living in a flat universe where I impose meaning on it? There is no shared life. There's just a set of values which I am the basis of. And I think in the modern period, when we have this rise of a sense of there is no shared moral universe we're all participating in and we can observe together and discover together, there's this highly individualistic notion where by an act of will, I impose meaning, in which case there is no common good. There's either just a bunch of atomized consumers or a bunch of atomized individual self-interested people, each in competition with each other to get their slice of the pie. And so it's a zero-sum game. Whereas a common good notion, both in the Catholic and Protestant tradition, says, no, there is a shared life to be discovered. It's hard work. It takes democratic struggle. And there are rich people who do bad things to poor people. But there is a shared life beyond what we immediately see, which we can be discovered through a political process. And it takes inculcation of certain virtues and habits of courage and patience and love of neighbor and these kinds of things to get there and discover that. But there definitely is a common life in which the flourishing of each, and this is a kind of schematic definition, the flourishing of each is dependent on the flourishing of all. So I can't be truly myself, I can't flourish as Luke Bretherton without you flourishing. And it's a symbiosis. We all flourish together or we all perish together. And that's a radically different notion from kind of modern voluntaristic ideas of just in like Brownian motion, individuals pinging off each other, either in the market or in politics, trying to gain power off each other. And that is the kind of, you might have heard of someone like Thomas Hobbes, comes through. It's a kind of cankered form of Protestantism, if I could put it like that, that is a kind of leads to a hyper individualism. So probably let me leave that there.
Yeah, that's great. Ed, would you like to give us your 5 minutes of taking those ideas a bit further?
Thank you very much. Let me approach this without any academic theological credentials at all. Focus on the idea of the commonwealth as a sister concept to the common good. The idea of the commonwealth or the common weal informed campaigns for social justice in this country for centuries, from levellers and chartists all the way through the cooperative movement, cooperative common weal. And it's the capturing of the idea of wealth in favour of a system focused on financial returns and financial benefits that has left ideas and talk about the common good or the commonwealth on the sides and in the margins. Just to introduce that very simply, and is a nice way of doing it, it's a time-honored way of doing it. Can you smile at me if you know the story of King Midas? I've got about a 99% there, so that's very positive. But there are different tellings of the story of King Midas, and maybe the story is retold for every generation. Maybe King Midas today would be an investment banker or someone. Aristotle actually tells the story of King Midas that everything he touched turned to gold. He was a king, but everything he touched turned to gold. And in the end, Aristotle has him just die. And then presumably, he kind of learned his lesson after that. Others have him touching his daughter, who is named Zoe, which is Greek for life. And when he touches his daughter and his daughter turns to gold, he realizes the limits of his conception of wealth. And I like that version of the story. John Ruskin in the 19th century, the art writer and critic, said that there is no wealth but life. But the way that wealth has been turned into something is that wealth is actually all about gold. Wealth is about turning as much of the planet as we can from nature into tradable financial commodity that someone can make a return out of. It's about bringing things that used to be outside of the market, unpaid work, work in the family, work in the community, into the market, organizing it through a focus on financial return. It's about measuring the economy through a measure of the turnover of money in the economy. And the point here isn't that wealth or the common good is not about money. The point wasn't that King Midas had too much money. That's a different story. That's the story of Croesus, who had too much money. It's that he didn't have the balance. He couldn't balance money with the rest of what really counts for the common good. And therefore, it's that sense of balance, that sense of redefining wealth, which is at the core, I think, of certainly the core of new economics, the idea that actually you can build an economy based on social justice. But it's also at the core of many of the campaigns and organizations that are represented here, that I see on T-shirts here in the room, that there is a focus and that we need to rebalance this focus purely on financial return, on investment, on measuring things through money, with a wider variety of what counts for the good life.
Thank you. So there's been plenty there for us to begin to think about. So I'm wondering, I want to open this to you now, whether you've got any questions or comments for either Luke or Anna or Ed in the light of what they've said. We will anchor this in practice in a few moments' time, but I wonder if there's comments or questions that's raised for you. And Claire has the microphone, so please just... do I want to pick people? Well, let's start. Where's the furthest back hand? Let's start at the back and work forward.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I just wondered if the panel would agree with me, and I'm trying to unify Protestant and Catholic voices here along with everybody else who supports the common good, whether they'd agree with the Brazilian radical educator Paulo Freire when he said that human fulfillment is only possible when people work together to transform their world.
Who would like to answer? Would you like to answer that one, Ed?
I think there's a deep truth in that in terms of the search for meaning in your work or in your life or your activities. There has to be something larger that is there. I see that I work in the cooperative sector, 7,000 businesses that are owned by a stakeholder, not owned by financial investors, owned by the people who are involved in the business. Some of those, like the foster care cooperative, for example, the magic of that is that people go into foster care, because they're wanting to meet the needs of somebody else. They're driven by that motivation to do some good. It's why they go into that area of business. They own the business so they can run it in ways that fit with their values. So I think that meeting other people's needs is core to good work. That you can't have work that is destructive of people, that creates inequality, or that is destructive of the planet. That kind of work is instrumental. So I think Paulo Freire is right in that purpose and a common good is core to creating meaningful work and meaningful livelihoods.
Anna?
I think he's absolutely right, and I'd say three things quickly. First of all...
Anna does things in threes.
Yeah, that's worrying, isn't it?
It's great.
I'm a frustrated preacher, clearly. So first of all, I think that he's putting his finger on the central fact about the common good. Why do we need a language that's the common good rather than public goods or individual goods? Well, it's the only kind of good that we can only achieve together with other people and that we cannot reduce to the level of the individual. So there is something irreducibly about togetherness that defines the common good, and it's why we need the word, okay? That's the first thing. The second is, however much we try to reinvent individualism in different ways, there is something so deeply set within our nature that means we search for collective identities. And if we look at our politics across the globe right now, we can see that wherever you try and suppress that, and if mainstream politics doesn't speak to it, it erupts in different forms, both for the good and also in very distorted forms. So I think that's my second Freirean moment. And then my third is that there is something so common to our identity that whenever we find a new political movement that's attempting to articulate this, it has a different riff or a different spin on Freire's phrase. And one of the things we need to be doing really carefully right now is figuring out which version of what's on offer to us right now best expresses this understanding of flourishing that comes by being together. Because now, right now, after a very long time in the desert, we actually have different options for working out what that might look like. And that's both terrifying and actually really exciting at the same time.
And I think you're going to say a lot more about that later this afternoon at 5:30.
That is my talk this afternoon.
Great, let's take another, can I take another question, please, Claire?
Thank
or comment.
Thank you. To what extent do you think a notion of rights is compatible with the idea of the common good?
Luke, do you want to pick that up?
So I think it depends how we understand the term rights, and I'll sound like a terrible ivory tower kind of quibbling on definitions, but it is very significant. If we understand rights as the possession of the individual, and we might call that roughly subjective notion of rights, and this grows out of, remember I mentioned Hobbes earlier. I mentioned Hobbes earlier and this other figure, John Locke, you might know of. The idea that the right comes from, it's based on a notion of property. I possess my body and no one can do anything to me with what I possess without my permission. And so the rights, I have rights as a possessor of property based on my body. And then I have to give my consent, and most ethical things, if you're involved in medical ethics or whatever, revolve around the giving of consent. Well, there's another conception of rights, which is actually we're all participants in a moral universe which has a right, not rights plural, but a notion of right. And then we have to discern and discover what that is, and that process of rights in the plural is derived from making judgments about what each deserves, the basic definition of justice, what is appropriate or fitting to give each person, given who they are and what they are. And that is based on a notion actually directly related to the common good. You can't have a notion of right in the plural from which we then derive notions of justice and how to act fittingly and appropriately in relation to each other without a notion of the common good. Because that enables us, we can really only determine how to give what is appropriate to each other when we have a sense of what we're heading for, technically what's called the telos or the good. So without a vision of the good and a sense of what we're trying to fulfill and achieve together through our common work, we can't make appropriate judgments about what we give to each other. So give you a classic example, we've had a beautiful illustration of that today in the Eucharistic service, if you were there, with the foregrounding of those with disabilities and from the livability work, and the sense in which in worship, those who are often most marginalized and those who often don't have a voice, we need to give them their due and give an extra place, an extra portion to them, both in terms of resources and voice, because of what they lack, because we're trying to reach for a vision of the common good in which the flourishing of everyone, whatever their ability, is fulfilled. But I can't make a judgment about what I should give each person, whether someone should get more and some should get less, without that vision of the good. If, in my earlier version, we're just each individual rights bearers spending our property how we choose, i.e. our body, there is nothing common between us, and that is the dominant framework within which human rights is generally understood. I don't think it needs to be understood like that, but it is generally understood like that. And it's the attendant of, and flip side of a coin, of a kind of notion of capitalism where we each try and get as much as what we kind of invest our property in making investments, and then can spend that how we choose. And there's no value attached to what we do with it, just as there's no value attached to what we do with our bodies. So I think there are very rival versions of notions of rights, and they lead in radically different directions.
Ed.
I'm going to have to be careful on how I say this, because fundamentally I believe in rights and in human rights within that. But there is a sense in which the conversation, the dialogue around human rights is all too often framed as about individuals and the fulfillment of individual needs and capabilities. What I like about that framing is that it does talk about issues of power, that there are reasons why we do not have as much common good as we ought to, and that's because of abuses of power or captures of power, and rights talks about that because it's a claim on somebody else to do something. But the most difficult area of human rights has been those that are the developmental rights, which are essentially need collective action. And the troubles that we have is that many of the big challenges that we face today, like climate change or inequality or mass migration, are they're collective action problems. They can't be resolved by individuals. And yet all of our politics tells us that's how things happen. Individual choice. Ulrich Beck, the German sociologist, has this phrase, which is quite a slightly complicated phrase, but it bears thinking about. He says that we are, in today's world, forced to live out and search for biographical solutions to systemic problems. Biographical solutions to systemic problems. So we're faced with fundamental fissures in the way that the world is going. And yet, we have to put that into an individual framing. Woody Allen had some of his early films. He said, inflation or depression in one of his films. And there was a poster, inflation or depression, how to dress for each. There was another one about the sun. The sun is a huge ball of hot, molten nuclear energy. It could fly out of orbit at any moment and crash into the Earth. The average citizen is advised as to what they can do in this context. And it's that, you know, just poking fun and revealing the extent to which part of the problem that we face is, and, you know, Anna and both talked about this, is sort of individualism. There's a radical individualism. And somehow we have to be able to get that sense of agency that is about individual human rights, but also that sense of collective action. To my mind, you know, the common good is not an absolute goal in itself, that it's in itself tempered by the extent to which it promotes individual freedom, individual pursuit of well-being. But that individual freedom is also tempered by social responsibility in terms of the impact that it has on others as well. Certain contexts, I think rights can be a progressive force for campaigning and for change. But at the same time, we also have to take off these glasses of individualism and really address the question whether political democracy, national or other levels, how we come together to act together, how we build the mandate for social justice.
Okay, so I think I want to try. We've been discussing some good high level concepts here. I think I'd like to anchor that a little bit now and ask you on a much more personal question, which is, what does the common good actually mean for you, and what differences does it make to you and your experience and what you find yourselves doing? I wonder if I could start with Anna on that one.
Can I cheat and answer that question and the question we've just had in the same?
Not so twice. Badly behaved, yes.
Okay.
Briefly.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to be in 3 points. Sorry to disappoint you. Okay, what does it mean to me personally? And by segueing, this is also why I see no inherent competition or difficulty in the relationship between rights and the common good. Catholic social teaching defines the common good in the least easy to trip off the tongue way ever, as the social conditions necessary for individuals and groups to flourish. Now, the emphasis of that definition, the social conditions that enable individuals and groups to flourish, is on agency. It's not on doing something for somebody else. It's not on helping them out. Those things are really important, but it's maximizing the capacity for individuals as persons in communities to flourish and to reach their own vocation, which cannot be done without the Freirean point of doing it together. But there's no inherent tension between my good and your good. There are difficulties with that, and there is a path of suffering, but it's really a choice between one kind of suffering and another kind of suffering in a world of evil. Okay? Now, the thing that makes it really important to me in this day and age is, first of all, it requires me to take other people who are different from me seriously. It requires me to listen, to engage, and potentially to find a route towards my own conversion through the encounter with the other person. Right now, we need that in neighborhoods across the land, and we need it interculturally. I'm doing a lot of work in the Middle East at the moment, in Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, and I'm trying to extend my accountability in that way as well. But the second thing I want to say, which is the thing that goes back to that point, is this. I think that we are in a world where politics, rights, etc., are fragile things. They're really important, but they're fragile. And we constantly, for the reasons that the good Protestant tradition alludes to, fail in the stuff we set out to do. Much of what Christian charities and Christian organizations do, not just Christian, is they make up for the deficit of love in our communal lives. Their common good practices are about restoration and resistance. So I'm thinking about a PhD that one of my students is doing on homelessness charities at the moment. And she's been testing out the phrase, the common good, with people who work in homelessness settings and with the homeless themselves. And they say, it's not a greatly resonant phrase, but the way that they understand that phrase is through the practices that restore human dignity, that restore a sense of people with complicated lives being agents of their own futures and part of meaningful communities. So for me, that emphasis is strongly on agency, on participation, on being members of a community, and remembering that common good practices, when they're prophetic, are about resistance and they're about restoration. And so much of what we need to be doing as faith communities is living into that space.
Thank you. So Luke, what difference does it, what does it mean for you personally?
That's a wonderful question. I think I want to kind of echo and pick up on some of what Anna was saying. I think for me, and this is actually drawn from Catholic social teaching, there's a lovely sense in Catholic social teaching that through what in the Latin is the munus, means vocation or office, that the sense in which we each have an office or vocation, which we can only discover with and through others. And that that is how we actually, so the kind of sense of fulfillment comes through this working together with others, that I discover who I truly am. And for me, the sense has been very profound, particularly through my work with London citizens, of working alongside particularly Muslims and Jews, and the notion of the common good, that beyond my particular commitments of faith and a sense of I want to live into and bear witness to the kingdom of God, there's also a shared life that is of goods in common. These are not necessarily eternal goods, they're earthly goods, but they need to be fought for and protected. If we want our kids to have somewhere to play, we've got to stop the council selling off the school playing fields for gentrifying property development. And so that sense in which, in discovering that sense of having a common good, and that my vocation is discovered through a life together with others, and that I am fulfilled through that, and therefore, despite very different understandings of the world, very different commitments to who, what it means to follow God, and what we even mean by God with religious others, there is this shared world. And actually through working together around things like a living wage, or stopping people getting into forms of debt bondage, or working for safer streets in a local community, I've discovered that shared bond in life with Muslims and Jews and secularists, and who in other contexts, or just in my community of faith context, I might be in conflict, or we might have radical disagreements about different things. Now, it's that sense in a very tricky world, which I think we're incredibly, I think it's very hard work anyway, and we live in a context that makes it even harder. of how do we have a nourishing sense of what it means to be different in relation. We don't all have to become new New York Times reading or Guardian reading, theatre going liberals to have a sense of shared life. Actually, there are processes through which we can put our roots down into our particular faith traditions, into what we most treasure and cherish and believe in, while also that enabling our walls to come down and building shares of common life through discovering goods together on which we all depend, whether that's good places for our kids to play, good schools, living wages, these kinds of things. And so the notion of the common good is a very hopeful sign, which I've experienced viscerally in reality, of this sense of both having to investigate and deepen my own sense of what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Christ through coming into relationship and discovering these shared goods with those who believe very different things from me and have a very different form of life and a very different history to me. And so that is a very significant part of my own experience and why I think this is such an important term.
Thank you. If I could just tell a little bit of a story about Nottingham Citizens. We, our very first big public action together, and this kind of sums up living out the common good for me, as a faith leader, was as we gathered people for the, it was a hugely risky thing. We said we were going to get 1,000 people into this meeting with the prospective candidates for the Police and Crime Commissioner post, which was being offered for the first time in Nottingham and Nottinghamshire. And we had schools, we had taxi drivers who had done a whole lot of series about what did they want to ask the Police and Crime Commissioner. And they were concerned about people attacking them and their personal safety, and doing the survey with them and a questionnaire with them, the Muslim community gathered their opinions about what they would want to ask the Police and Crime Commissioner. So we had taxi drivers, particularly from the Kashmiri community in Nottingham. We had we had churches, we had the Students' Union who were concerned about the nighttime economy in the city centre, and they wanted to talk to the Police and Crime Commissioner about that. We had school children telling the story of harassment on the way to school and sexual propositioning, and how they wanted to ask the Crime Commissioner for a different way of reporting that sort of crime. And everybody gathered in the same place in Trent Vineyard Church. And we invited people who were kind of interested in finding out about working together with all these strange institutions, people who weren't very sure they had anything in common with the church down the road or the trade union branch that met in the workplace. And as you walked in, the gasps of amazement of the diversity of the room were astounding. Many people said, I have never been in a space like this where there are so many people from across the community in Nottingham. This is the city I live with. I think the only other time it happens is at Goose Fair, which is a great big fairground thing that happens in October. Everybody comes out for that. The common good, there were particular and different issues, but we wanted our Police and Crime Commissioner to commit to work with us as an alliance and to say yes to working with us on those particular issues. And school children, taxi drivers, others stood up and told their story and experience. And it's not about me and what I think is a good idea. It's having listened in our communities, people telling their own stories to power, to those who would have that power, and to say, we want to work with you to change this. Will you do it? And making them answer the question in a public assembly, will you work with us? And they say yes, because they're on the spot. It's a reasonable request, and there's 1,000 people saying we're with that school child who wants a different way of coming to school. So for me, the common good is that expression of we are individual and yet we have these common issues that we want to see made different. Ed, commonly personally to you.
Well, thank you. Follow that. I mean, I just want to say to you, Karen, and to Luke as well, you know, congratulations on your work and the work of so many people involved in Citizens UK, others here in the room I know. Our members are cooperatives across the UK. That includes credit unions operating at the kind of cutting edge, really, of issues around financial inclusion. And I know the difference that the work, that the campaigning at a grassroots level and a national level has made and still needs to make. So just, you know, kind of huge congratulations to you both on that. I think your question was, what does it mean in practice?
Yeah, and personally to you, yeah. What does it look like?
If it's all right, I'll just tell two very brief stories.
Okay, and then we'll come.
The first was,
give you chances to tell stories too.
First was, I left university a long time ago. It wasn't yesterday, you can probably tell that. And met up with a team of other people. And we were inspired by a slightly crazy idea. And the inspiration for us was something called the wool mark. Anybody here remember the wool mark? Okay, great. Still exists. It does. It does indeed. But at the time, this is the mid-80s, it was absolutely, you know, the kind of the best known consumer assurance brand that was there. And we had the idea, inspired by the idea of the common good, that we wanted to do a wool mark for global justice. It's a slightly mad idea. We set about it, and what we came up with was the fair trade mark. Drew very much on work going back, companies like Tradecraft, cooperative groups like Twin Trading and others. But it created a mark that could then be sold and taken out publicly. And in the early days, no one kind of thought this was particularly a clever idea. We went out to talk to the supermarkets. One supermarket said it was a mad idea, only Vickers would buy it. We went to see Marks and Spencer, and this was, you know, a while back, and M&S told us that the idea that any label could be more trusted than Marks and Spencer's itself was ridiculous. And this was a week or two before they were exposed on Panorama for allegedly using child labour in their supply chains. The Co-op actually was the first retailer that said yes and took those early fair trade products kind of out onto the market. That got me involved in the sense of what we could do and could do acting together. But it was the second thing that gave it an additional meaning when I was involved in campaigning on issues of third world debt. And with an inspiring woman who's also talking here at Greenbelt, Anne Pettifer, who I was able to bring in, we renewed a campaign that was called Jubilee 2000. And I don't know if there's members here in the tent of people that were involved in that.
Who got involved in Jubilee 2000?
Oh, just like, you guys, look, well done to you. You know, we really did something special. I have to say the campaign failed. We didn't get the debt cancelled that we wanted to for all of the countries that we wanted to. But we did do it for a huge number of the very poorest countries, particularly with the government-to-government debts. The primary school enrollment rate in Tanzania, where you work, Karen, doubled as a result of the debt relief that Tanzania was able to get coming out of the decisions of the world leaders in the years running up to 2000. And beyond. That doesn't mean to say that there's not a lot of other issues that are out there. But I kind of, as I say on the fair trade side, just because you can't do everything on issues like global justice doesn't mean that you can't do something. And fair trade is an example of something practical that you can do. Being a member of a co-op is something practical, something you can do. Here's my phone, it's a fair phone, it's from the phone co-op. Pretty much most of your economic life, the money you spend, can be spent through ethical businesses like co-ops. Might take a little bit more effort, but actually you're doing something that is recycling that.
Or credit unions.
Yeah. Now, Jubilee 2000, Anne and I were both staunchly atheist. And we said to each other when we started this work, in about 1995, Anne came in, we said, look, this is a mad campaign. This is trying to do something absolutely huge. If it works, it surely proves that maybe there's a God out there. And we laughed at each other and, you know, as two staunch atheists, you know, kind of, it wasn't quite a Pascal's wager. But it was a conversation that echoed for both of us. It worked its way through. And both of us found, when we met up, and we, I remember kind of sitting in a cafe in Edinburgh, Scotland being one of the most active in supporters of the campaign, and we realised that the campaign hadn't succeeded in total, and yet both of us had come to know and understand a faith, a Christian faith, that meant something to each of us. So the common good for me is that mix of doing things for good and then being able to frame that in a way that, in a spiritual way, I think that is and can be transformative, that is something of hope.
So it's not just about changing the world, it's about being changed through that encounter with the other. Luke, just briefly,
What Ed was saying is really wonderful, but I think just to kind of amplify that in one quick way, I think this sense in which we often get caught up in notions of power and think of politics in terms of power in quite negative ways. But this notion of the common good and what we've been talking about is that the power lies between us. It's relational power. All of these things, credit unions, cooperatives, the kinds of campaigning work that have been talked about, depend on us having relational power. And the more people there are, the more they were involved in Jubilee, the more they're involved in a credit union, the more they're involved in a cooperative, the more powerful it is. It's power with. And that's a very constructive form of power through which each of us comes to discover our agency, comes to be more than we are as alone. And that's very different from how we often think about power as power over the kind of command and control bureaucratic forms of power we often experience in the workplace. And so what we've been talking about is, on the one hand, a kind of democratic vision of us discovering together our shared life and common goods, and that's a kind of political place-based form about renewing our neighborhoods, towns, counties.
In public space.
And public space. But yep. There's also work-based forms. And that was what Ed's been talking about in terms of cooperatives. We can think of unions. The more people are in the union and having power with, can transform their workplaces. And this intersection of place-based and workplace coming together and discovering power and discovering goods that enables us then to really create just and generous places of mutual flourishing.
Okay, so I wonder if I could invite you now to have a conversation with somebody next to you, preferably somebody you don't know, and to have a conversation about your experiences of acting in power with, your experience of acting for the common good with others. And then I'm going to ask for a little bit of feedback, but I'm not going to ask you what you said. I'm going to ask people to contribute a story that they have heard. So would you like to turn to someone and have a conversation about your experience of acting for the common good with others, power with? And you've got 5 minutes. Okay. Can I ask you to draw those questions, those stories to a close? Thank you. So who among you has heard something so inspiring that you would like everyone to know about it? I want to hear a story that you have heard, not your story, but a story you have heard. Who'd like to share a story with us? Okay. With the microphone. And who else would like to share a story they have heard? Gentleman in the white t-shirt next, and then the lady in the red chair. Thanks.
Quite a short and brief one, but Devesh was telling me about his running club, where they get together and they go running, and that's a nice community thing, but they run to somewhere and do something. So I thought that was really cool, and they do something actively together to make their community a better place, but also in their nice, sociable, we're making friends and doing something we want to do together. And I thought that was really awesome.
Thank you.
Hello there. I had a quick chat with Rory. This is Rory here. And we all agreed that, first of all of the speakers have articulated their views really well, very articulate in imparting their knowledge and their experience. So thank you for that. We also agreed that it's a really good theme for the festival, even if we're trying to work out what it means. And simply, the point that Rory was making with me is that he feels that he's trying to explore. There's something about the theme of the common good that really excites him. He's trying to explore what it means and tease it out. So being here is part of his journey. We haven't had time to even, I don't know how far along that journey he is, but you have to start somewhere. And Rory has a Manchester connection, and we were reflecting on the point that sometimes it's a real shame that it takes awful and terrible things to happen in order to mobilise people, and we were just reflecting in terms of how that could perhaps be flipped over to a different starting point for mass mobilisation.
Thank you.
Hi, I have an interest in the environment, which my colleague does here. We've spoken about it already. He's been to speak with you, Anna, I think, just now, but he's agreed that I can say something about what we talked about, but it's really my idea. And that is this: at its most basic level, if you said to anybody, what is the common good? I would say the environment. You know, whether you're the queen or an ant or us, we all need clean air and we all need clean water. Even before you've grown any food to eat, we all need those basic things. One of the things that's bothering me at the moment, but it does reflect on what you said, Anna, that we are at the moment on the cusp of something exciting but also terrifying, is the concept of natural capital and ecosystem services benefits. And if you don't know what those are, please go and look on the internet, because it's a way of simultaneously valuing the environment, what it provides us with, but it's also a way, I think, of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. So that's a sort of observation which Alan has very kindly allowed me to make. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So can I ask each of you to comment on what you've heard?
Begin. So there's the lovely, there's a really fantastic illustration. So I think just to kind of riff off them, I think the first story is a wonderful story of how actually shared action can be born out of a joy of doing something together. And in a sense, in Christian terms, we might talk about that in terms of praise, how actually it's in discovering joy and praising together. I think about singing together, we've just done. We discover our shared life together through that kind of extensive movement out beyond oneself and discovering, let's say in the image of a choir, what we have together. And I think often politics is a bit dour. And there's a great action by Saul Alinsky, who's a key figure in community organizing, where he says, never do an action that's not fun. And I think it's always a good, you know, there should be a good rule. If people around you in your action are looking, you make a joke and someone says, that's not funny. You know, you're probably in the wrong place. They're a bit over-invested. And there's a serious point here, which is when we get over-invested in political things and the pursuit of earthly goods and lose sight of a vision of hope and joy to come, then we can start justifying anything. The means starts justifying any ends. The ends start justifying any means to achieve that. And we end up with forms of totalitarian or oppressive politics and domination. So joy is a key element of politics. Politics which leads to signs of praise and wonder and joy and amazement should be a key thing. But then we had another issue around issues of suffering, like in Manchester or Grenfell, which is around the corner from where I live, and the place of lament alongside praise as a key motivator of politics. And that sense in which out of a vision of someone else's suffering, we're moved to act with or for them. And so that oscillation between praise and lament are two key motivators for this kind of common action. And then I think lastly, just making a point about the environment, If we go back to Genesis, the Adam, that sense of the shared human, it's not Adam, the proper name, but Adam, the shared human, comes from Adama, the soil. And so the spirit, with spirit-breathed soil in Hebrew. And so Adam, there is no Adam without Adama, and the shared soil on which the flourishing, literally the cultivation, and the image is an agrarian image, the cultivation of our humanity through the cultivation of the soil. And so that deep symbiosis between the flourishing of humans and the flourishing, literally, of the most basic form on which all animate life depends, which is the soil and the bacteria and microbiome in the soil. And if you don't know, it's wonderful, if we read up about the interconnection between the microbiome in your gut and the microbiome in the soil and how the interdependence between them. So we literally are this notion of the commons we have, the, whether it's the fish, the air, the forests, the common life we have with the earth around us and the common life we share as humans are deeply interconnected.
Ed, want to hear Ed second?
I'll go third.
Ed, you go third, okay. Anna?
Okay, that probably works because I want to add to what Lucas said and echo that by picking up on the themes of kind of things that are joyful, things that give us pleasure. One of the things we can do is turn politics into a really hard work, okay? And that gets dull and eventually everybody goes home, okay? So one of the things we need to do is spot how we're built as human beings. What are we built for? What are the things that genuinely nurture us and give us pleasure? Thinking about things like running clubs. I've just come back from Lebanon, where I was working with organizations who are supporting refugees on the ground, looking particularly at how refugees are supporting other refugees. And in Beirut, those who are the communities, the local communities who are hosting incoming Syrian refugees are very often themselves Palestinian refugees. So it's refugees from one generation hosting another generation. There's loads of NGOs and organizations who are trying to structure solidarity and offer help. But when we talked to a group of refugees and we said, what's been most helpful to you? They said, a football club. And what had happened is that members of the local community and a group who live within an urban camp area had decided that the one time of day that wasn't fully regulated and filled with people trying to do helpful interventions was the night time. And it's also a time where they also, in other ways, feel quite controlled. So to take back control of that space, they set up a football team that allowed the local community and the refugee community to play football together. Now, what happened was not just that they did something that they're built to do that gave them pleasure and a sense of release of stress from all the other stuff going on, but it became a place for economic regeneration. Because what happened when they were playing football and afterwards was they started to make business deals. Part of the community started to lend to the other part of the community as they started to trust each other. And of course, one of the things they pointed out was, well, when we first started playing football, we didn't really want to compete too hard with them because we didn't really trust them. But actually, once we started to like them and trust them, we like really seriously wanted to beat them. But this spirit of competition and actually doing something pleasurable that was a recognition of their basic humanity humanized the economy they were trying to live in and create, as well as some of the political and humanitarian structures. So we need to start with the things that bring us joy. Politics is not just about hard work and misery.
And a good example of joy and coming together is Barcelona Football Club, which operates as a cooperative, has more members than it can fit into the ground. And there are some of those coming into the UK as well. Lincoln City, they're not quite operating on the same level at the moment. I work at Cooperatives UK with my colleague John, who's in the Cooperate or Die t-shirt.
Give us a wave, John, so we can see you.
Oh, wow. Okay. There's a world behind you, John, as well. But the our office was closed because we were in the vicinity of the bombs in Manchester. And it was so moving how the aftermath, that it brought out the best of the people of Manchester, certainly. And it's sad that it had to take something like that to do that, to remind us in ways of who we really are. But I love the way that music also played its part. And I've got a request of you, if that's okay. And it's a bit cheeky, and I've never done this before. But it does link loosely, very loosely, to the question about the environment, which is, of course, a question about who do we consider is in the common good? Who is it that we are in common with? Is it British people? Is it people of Manchester? Is it white people? Is it every people? Is it other species? Is it the planet itself? That question. Me personally, I'm a vegetarian, so I kind of have animals in there somewhere in a confused way that involves eating a lot of corn and cheese. So here's my request to you, and it'd be very brief. I would love to sing, because I want to be able to tell everybody, including my colleagues at work, that I sang at a festival over the summer. And it's a very short song about vegetarian rights. And I just, could we do this democratically, Karen? Or do you get the casting vote on this?
Well, let's have an election. Of course, that is not the only way to act together in a democratic process. Luke is going to eat me afterwards for saying that. Are we happy to sing? Hands in the air? Yes, I think I am. Consensus.
Okay, right. Thanks so much.
That's the most ancient form, voting by acclamation.
And I, outside of a Sunday service, I am no singer, so that is the caveat as well. Proper singers across the way. But it's a vegetarian song, and it goes like this. Don't be cruel to a vegetable. Always take its part. Don't be cruel to a vegetable, and remember that a lettuce has a heart. If you please, don't split peas just because they're tasty to the tongue. And never forget that if you order Brussels sprouts, you're robbing a cabbage of its young.